Welcome to the How to Be Awesome at Your Job podcast, the show where brilliant professionals share how to sharpen the universal skills required to flourish at work. Enjoy more career fun, wins, meaning, and money with your host, Pete Mikaitis.
Hello, and thanks for joining us here for episode 546 with David Marquet. David is a former nuclear submarine commander who's learned a thing or two about how little shifts in your language can have big impact in your organization, the people that you're communicating with. He's gotten some strong praise from folks like Stephen Covey. So you're going to learn, one, how language impacts your leadership, two, how to use dissent in the workplace to your advantage, and three, how we're mistaking coercion for leadership. If you want to see the show notes, the transcript, the links to items we've referenced, it's over at awesomeatyourjob.com/ep546, or you can expand your episode notes, details, descriptions, as it's called in your assorted apps, and just tap it to get there all the faster that way. Now, here's David's story. David Marquet is a student of leadership and organizational design and a former nuclear submarine commander. He was named one of the top 100 leadership speakers by Inc. magazine and is the author of the Amazon number one bestseller, Turn the Ship Around, and the Turn the Ship Around workbook. David's new book, Leadership is Language, released recently by Penguin Random House. Big thanks to David for sharing his wisdom with us. Big thanks to our sponsors. Check them out. One sponsor to check out is Storyworth, who's offering $10 off your first purchase at storyworth.com/awesome. Whenever I'm thinking about meaningful Mother's Day gifts, Storyworth leaps to mind. Storyworth is an online service that makes it fun and easy to write an entire book of life memories and preserve them for years to come. Each week, Storyworth emails your loved ones a single life-related question that you pick from their collection, like, what's the bravest thing you've ever done? I have personally loved their prompts so much that I have refreshed their questions page many times. All they have to do is reply with their story. After a year, Storyworth compiles those stories, memories, and even photos into a beautiful hardcover book to provide a valued keepsake. Families love Storyworth so much, they've got 25,000 five-star reviews on Trustpilot with millions of stories preserved. Give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift you'll all cherish for years, Storyworth. And right now, you can save $10 on your first purchase when you go to storyworth.com/awesome. That's storyworth.com/awesome for $10 off your first purchase. Here is David. David, thanks for joining us here on the How to Be Awesome at Your Job podcast.
Thanks for having me on your show, Pete.
Well, I think the first thing I need to address is, have you in fact crossed the United States on your bicycle?
Yeah. I've done segments of it, not all at the same time, but I've done various segments. So last summer, I went from Boise, Idaho to Casper, Wyoming, which was epic because it took me over the Tetons and through Teton Pass. Now, I live in Florida. Like an overpass is a hill. Mm-hmm. So I'm out there and it's like turn left, summit 20 miles that way, 4,000 feet that way. And I just looked at that. I was like, are you kidding me? But I made it through.
Well, good work. Good work.
Thank you.
My dad was a big bicyclist. And so respect. We have hosted bicyclists at our childhood home, I recall, as they were crossing that nation. They were from Australia. My mom said, they sure eat a lot.
Yeah. That's why you're a cyclist. So you can eat a lot. You broke the code.
Well, so speaking of breaking the code, just as we were chit-chatting before pushing record, you keyed in on my bookshelf, Stephen Covey's The Eighth Habit. And you've got a cool Stephen Covey connection. Can you lay it on us?
Yeah, so when I was submarine commander on the Santa Fe, we were doing a lot of Seven Habits stuff. And in some respects, everything that we did, which I write about and Turn the Ship Around, was simply applying the Seven Habits, which is kind of written at an individual level, at an organizational level. So have a one, be proactive. And we kept asking the question, what would it sound like if everybody in the organization acted proactively, and then we would put some words to it, and then we'd practice those words, and magic, it worked. And so we would do that. And so when we started winning all these awards, the story got out, and Dr. Covey was doing this work with the Navy back on the East Coast, and he heard about it, and they get this phone call, Dr. Covey wants to come ride your submarine. I'm like, Dr. Stephen Covey. And I was just like running around in circles, like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. And he came out. It was such an amazing day. we picked them up off of Maui. It was crystal clear. Dolphins were jumping. I mean, it was just one of those just magic moments. And he's really quiet, kind of nervous. And he walks around the ship and he finally comes up to me at the end. We're driving into Pearl Harbor, standing on the bridge. And he says, I know, I figured it out. First, he says, it's the most empowering workplace I've ever seen. I said, well, thank you very much.
We don't use that word. Superlative from a man who's seen a lot. That's awesome.
Yeah, right, right.
Congrats.
But I didn't like the word empowerment. I didn't use it because I thought it was, I labeled it a polluted word because it meant everyone had already attached meaning to it. So it was when you said the word, you got whatever you got. I mean, everyone sort of looked at it through their own lens. But anyway, he's, and we talked, but it was magic. And then he said, I'm going to write about you. And I'm like, yeah, sure. And then in The Eighth Habit, which I see on your bookshelf behind you, I always like to spy. I look at the bookshelves behind.
Yeah.
And I see The Eighth Habit. So, and that was really amazing. And then he wrote the foreword for Turn the Ship Around. Unfortunately, he passed away like a month after he wrote. We got the foreword like on the 1st of April. And he went in, he had his bicycle accident. Later that month, it was like the 20th or something, about 3 weeks later, really tragic, never came out of the coma. So that was a huge loss.
Yes. Well, his legacy is living on, you know, through those who he teaches and has taught and touched. And you're a shining example. And you, in turn, are passing the wisdom along. And one of your big areas of focus is the language, the actual word choice that folks use. Can you kind of lay that on us? Like, what's your big kind of aha or insight or discovery into the notion of language and leading?
So here's the deal. All the words that seem natural and normal to us, they sound normal in our ear, like all hands meeting or having a can-do organization. And all those words, the reason they're natural is because we've heard them from our bosses and our parents who heard them from their bosses and their parents, which means they're from the industrial age.
Okay.
And essentially, it amounts to a programming, a playbook, I like to think of it, so that in a certain situation, we're going to react in a certain way. So someone comes up to you and tells you, gives you news that you don't like, hey, I think we should delay product release next week. And this comes as unwelcome news, of course. People react in different ways, but I predict it's going to be react, respond, reply. They're going to either explain why they're wrong, they're going to defend themselves, something like that. Rarely will I see curiosity. Oh, what do you see that I'm missing? What do you know that I don't know? And the question is that I was always struggling with is why does my programming take me in the unhelpful direction? Here's another example. We tend to ask binary questions. And especially the least helpful binary question is a self-affirming binary question. Does that make sense? Right?
Does that make sense?
Right. So, right? So it's not really a question. I just want to get everyone to agree and go along with me.
Well, I'm just thinking about how lame my podcast would be if those are the questions I asked.
Yeah.
Right. It's like the Pete Show and you're just an accessory.
Right, exactly. But I see leaders doing this. I hear leaders doing this all the time. And I think the reason is because in the industrial age, that's what you wanted. You just wanted people to do what you wanted them to do. You didn't want a big discussion, and I didn't need the workers to be involved in decision-making. But of course, now that doesn't work anymore. We need to let the people doing the work be involved in making decisions about the work. And so what that means is all these language patterns, which we've been programmed to do, are no longer helpful. So we have to go through the great reprogramming of the English language.
Okay. Well, so can you lay it on us in terms of, we got a few examples of things that don't work. Are we good? You know, makes sense.
Yeah.
And so those are not ideal, not optimal. And the principle is that it doesn't encourage conversation, engagement, discussion. It's just sort of like, okay, you know, let's move it along here.
And in particular, dissenting, diverse, and outlying opinions. These things reduce the likelihood. They don't squish it to zero. But it's just these are biases one direction or the other. They just make it a little bit harder for the person who doesn't agree with the group to speak up. And that's a problem.
Yeah. You know, I think it is a problem. And it's funny, as we record these words, Mitt Romney, got some attention for a dissenting opinion.
Yeah. But look at the reaction, right? I didn't hear anybody. I was flying today, so I missed a bunch of the news, but I didn't hear any responses. Oh, Mitt, tell us more about that. I'm so curious about your perspective. I didn't hear that. What I heard was, oh, you're wrong, you're screwed up, you're blah, 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 blah. Or you're right, we agree with you. Blah. So this is a good example of how these program responses, and you see it all the time and everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. So yes, there seems to be a bias against dissent. So let's dig in. So how do we get better language? Can you give us some core fundamental principles as well as some particular examples of, hey, let's stop saying this and say that instead?
Yeah. So the key way, one way to think about it is, are you embracing variability or are you reducing variability? Now, there are lots of work following a procedure, manufacturing a part, that benefit from reducing variability. And actually, this is the problem, because this is what we've inherited from the industrial age. Mm-hmm. We want, imagine you're making Lego blocks. I don't want the holes to be like a little bit fatter or a little bit skinnier because they won't stack up very well. I want it always the same. So variability is an enemy. And we've been gotten really good at tuning out variability. But decision-making and thinking benefits from embracing variability. The fact that we have special rules when we go into we're going to do a brainstorming session. We're going to have some special rules so we can invoke creativity. What that means is the normal way we do work at work kills creativity. It's just an admission of that. So what we need to do is have the language of work, which allows dissenting opinions. So here's one thing that a lot of people do wrong. If you're doing a decision meeting, what you want to do is vote first, then discuss. What most people do is they'll talk about it. All this does is serve to anchor the group. Let's groupthink build up. Let's the people who think different than the group, they start shrinking down in their chair. And it becomes very hard to disagree. Well, I don't think 737 Mac software is safe. I don't think we should do the launch. Whatever happens. Every innovation starts as an outlying and dissenting opinion. The water in Flint, Michigan is poison, whatever. They always start on the fringes. And sometimes they deserve to stay out there on the fringes, but sometimes they don't. But you don't know that if A, you suppress them so you don't even hear them, or B, you don't listen to them when they're voiced. So So what you want to do is vote first in a probabilistic way. Here's the trick. Start the question with the word how. How sure are you? How strongly do you support this? How likely is this assumption to be true? Not will it be true? Is it safe? Are there weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? Any question about the future is going to be should be probabilistic because we don't know. And then after the vote, you look for the people who voted highest for and highest against. These are the outliers. They're on the fringes. And you invite them to speak.
Now, just if I got a quick time out there. So highest for and highest against.
Yeah.
So then it's not a simple, I'm for this, I'm against this, but rather I'm a zero, I'm a 100, or how are you thinking about the voting?
Yeah. So you can use your hand. So we do, if it's just really quick, you're out in the field. Mm-hmm. It's a team about a construction site team. Hey, we're ready to start the next phase. We're ready to pour concrete. How ready are we to do this? Mm-hmm. And people put their hands up. 5, 5, 5, 4. 5, 5, 4. Okay.
Okay.
It's a lot easier because someone could send us, it's easy for someone to say 4 instead of 5, but it's very difficult for someone to actually put their hand up and do a thumbs down.
There's
a big cultural stigma to that. So you got to ask.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And when we use in the office, we have a set of cards that go 1 to 99, 1, 5, 20, 50, 80, 95, 99, 1 to 99. The key, because you don't want to do 0 and 100, because what you're trying to do is reprogram people's brains to think probabilistically.
Yeah.
So that nothing is 100 or 1. It's like there's never 0 chance and there's never 0, 100 chance of something happening. Will this product work?
Oh, David. I am loving this so much. And I just recently with my team, as we're assessing, this is pretty meta, podcast guests, I said, okay, this numbering system might not make sense to you, but it'd be really easy for me if in our system, You were to give me a number between 0 and 100 based upon the probability, your best guess, that this guest will be in the top 10% of engagement amongst all of our guests.
Beautiful.
And then that makes it easy for me as I just sort, like, all right, these are the people my team loves. You know, let's start at the top and move on down.
Yeah, that's so much better than saying, will this be in the top 10%, which is impossible.
Like, yes or no to David, you know?
Yeah,
it's much broader. Uh-huh.
Right. What's your sense? Yeah. I love that.
Cool. All right. So I'm jiving here. So we're thinking probabilistically. We're voting in advance. What are some of the other best practices?
So when it comes to asking questions, there's a whole bunch of things. The key is when you're asking questions, most people ask questions. They're either actively inserting their own viewpoint into the question. Like, why would you want to do that? Mm-hmm. Hey, I think we should delay launch. Product launch. Why would you want? So you're sending the signal, hey, you're wrong. This is unwelcome news. You need to defend it. Versus, oh, what do you see that's behind that thinking in a very sort of neutral way? So the idea is you want to be curious before compelling. You want to ask questions. You want to wipe your mind clean and not inject your point of view. Even when you're not deliberately trying to inject your point of view, we sometimes inject the point of view. And there's this sub school of asking questions called clean language, which I pulled some inspirations from. Really interesting. So for example, if your friend comes up to you and says, I'm having trouble with this coworker, you might say, well, do you have the guts to stand up to them? Well, this implies a whole bunch of things like, A, you should stay, like standing up to them is the right thing to do. It's the right metaphor, not punch them in the face or not let them alone. And do you have the guts to suggest that the limiting
Virtuous.
Resource is courage, not maybe it's time. So you're injecting all these, all your basic experience of what you think they're saying into the question. So what you want to try and do is just say, oh, tell me more, or yeah, what kind of a problem is that? And just be as neutral as possible about it. The way I think about it is I wipe my mind clean. I just, which is easier some days than others, but I just try and make a bleak, big white tableau in my head and say, I don't know anything. And my job is to learn as much as possible in the next couple of minutes. Now, I'm not saying you have to agree. They come up and say, hey, I think we should delay product launch. I'm not saying automatically delay product launch, not at all. But what I'm saying is make the decision after you've listened to them. If you find yourself saying the words, I hear you, but that's code for I'm not listening to you. Because the only reason you feel compelled to say, I hear you, is because you have a sense that they think you're not hearing them. So you feel compelled to say, I hear you. No one ever felt more heard because someone said, oh, I hear you. So just listen to them and you'll never feel the compulsion to say, I hear you.
Yeah.
Trust me is another one. If you find yourself saying, trust me, then you're on the wrong track. You should never have to say that.
Yeah. Keep it going. So you're sharing some phrases that are indicative of something beneath the surface that's not working. And it's hitting home. I think I've said, I hear you.
Yeah. me too. All the time. But so it goes back to the industrial age and what I'm calling this playbook. So the key thing in the industrial age, the key play, so to speak, is I label obey the clock. That's why we have words like clockwork. That's why we pay people by the hour, especially the people, the workers. We can pay the thinkers by salary, but the workers get paid by the hour because obey the clock. So there's all these cultural stigmas against saying, time out, I think we ought to delay product launch, because it runs against the obey the clock play. Now, the problem with obey the clock is, of course, it's very hard to think when you have the pressure of the clock, tick, 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 and you got to make so many widgets per hour. So what leaders want to do is what I call control the clock. Leaders need to say, hey, time out. We got time to, you guys are doing a great job chopping down this forest. Now I want to talk about, is this the right forest? And should we be chopping it down? And let's give the team the ability to say time out. Now, it's not enough to just say, oh, team, everyone can say time out. I've seen this in, say, for example, in a hospital situation or.
Right. Or some manufacturing plants.
Yeah, a manufacturing plant, nuclear power plant. There's this lip service. Oh, well, anyone can stop. But if you don't actually give them a mechanism, okay, here's a yellow card. If you think we need to take a pause, raise it or say the following code word. And practice. if it's never practiced, the same stigmas will build up. But if we practice it, and then it's like, oh, it's not a big deal. Time out, quick. This doesn't need to be a long time. You have to make it easy to exit production and go into thinking, but you also have to make it easy to say, okay, we're done thinking. Now we're going to go back to work. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you end up biased in one direction or the other.
Yeah, certainly. And so you encourage it, you practice it, you give a mechanism, and you appreciate it, I guess, when they use the mechanism. As opposed to like, oh, dang it, David, what is it now?
This is, yeah. You know? So a perfect example of this is the andon cord in the Toyota production system. This is, andon is the Japanese word for lantern. And so they've equipped the stations with what used to be a cord, now a button for the workers. They're in the production line. Parts are moving past them. They have a problem. So they can't solve the problem while the parts are moving. That's too much time pressure. So they have to push the button, which signals, hey, I've got a problem. I need to shift into problem-solving mode. I need to pause. I need to call a pause and shift to problem-solving mode. And so that's what that serves. That serves as a way for the – so we go to a construction site and say, well, how do the guys signal that they have a problem? A guy's on the third floor installing windows. And they've got a problem. There's no way, we haven't instituted a mechanism like Toyota Production System. So there's no way
to start yelling.
They just yell at each other.
Hey.
Right. Or we come down at the end of shift to say, yeah, I had to bang a few windows in because it really didn't fit quite right. Oh, it would have been nice to actually solve the root problem. No.
All right. So we're thinking about the clock.
So that's obey the clock. Yeah. That's the core play. So everything kind of stems out of that. And the second thing about the industrial age organization is we separate thinkers from doers. That's why we have these phrases like white collar, blue collars, leaders, followers, thinkers, doers.
Mm-hmm. There's some terms in Hebrew, dosh gaval, and the other one. Yeah, we've got these dichotomies. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. They're binary dichotomies, and we bend people into one of two tribes. And so when I think about, okay, well, what's it like to be a doer? Well, all you do is do what you're told. So all leadership is coercive because it's one group of people choosing what the other group of people ought to do. And then their role is to then comply and continue the production line as long as possible. And so again, these are unhelpful patterns because coercion isn't a good way to treat people. It's much better to have collaboration and commitment. Now, here's the trick. We talked about the meeting thing. So I had 10 executives from a big company, two tables of five, and I gave them a problem. It was like, well, how many countries are in Africa? You can't look it up. And someone at the end of one table blurts out a number. Let's say they say 50. And pretty soon the table comes at 50. And here's the other thing. Your table has to agree. Mm-hmm. You got to agree. So it's a decision-making exercise for a group. Your table has to agree because they have to decide what their number is. Pretty soon, 50. And guess what? 30 seconds later, the other table said 50. Now, who was the person who said 50? It was the CEO and the co-founder. So that person is paying a lot of people a lot of money simply to echo back what that person's thinking. Now, here's the key. When I said, oh, did you guys collaborate on this? Oh, yeah, sure. Everyone's voice was heard. No, it wasn't. This is called coercion. And so people use the word influence. Inspire, but it's really coercion. Like, let's not pretend it's not coercion. I'm getting you to do what I want you to do. And that's coercion. So what you want is true collaboration. And that happens first. Say, everybody write down what you think the number is before we contaminate you with any groupthink. Then everyone flips their cards up and just like before, let's look at the high and the low. Okay, how'd you come up with your number? How'd you come up with your number? And now we can coalesce on a number. The maximum amount of variability in the group, the maximum amount of cognitive diversity will occur before any conversation. And you want to capture that moment in time. But I should know the answer to that. I think they're 89. All right, no, those 54. Sorry, my bad, 54. Now, here's another thing that's interesting. If you ask people, okay, write down the last two digits of your phone number.
Okay.
Now write down how many countries there are you think in Africa.
Yeah.
Do those numbers correlate? Answer, yes. Should they? No. And this is anchoring. Even when you explain to people that anchoring is a phenomenon, it will still happen. So these are the perils of throwing out your answer first. But we do it because we want to move so quickly away from that uncertainty and variability. We want to collapse variability prematurely, mm-hmm. without giving it the cognitive respect that it's owed.
Oh, David, this is so good. This is just really getting my wheels turning here.
I'm so glad. That's the highest praise.
And the anchoring, well, I heard another study about anchoring, like that even judges, right, like perhaps the most impartial of all, would be anchored by the address on a piece of stationery or in a, like a mock case that they presented to them in terms of like what should the settlement amount or judgment arbitration amount be in a case. Like it has nothing to do with that. Yeah. These are supposed to be our most impartial and brilliant arbiters of decision making that we have in our society, and they succumb to it. So nobody's immune.
Yeah, so we all have these biases and they're wired into us. And you want to inoculate yourself and your team as much as possible, but it's very difficult. Here's another thing. The bias is called escalation of commitment, which means that if you made a decision, you've basically tainted yourself from evaluating that decision. And in the face of evidence that the decision was not a good one, basically, you double down. Now, we have phrases like in for a penny, in for a pound, sunk cost fallacy. But the way this plays out in organizations is, let's say the captain of a cruise ship makes a decision to do something and someone lower on the team starts to, or there's evidence that this is not a good idea. It's going to be very difficult for that person to reverse their decision. On the other hand, if you separate decision maker from decision evaluator, so the senior person should reserve their cognitive efforts to simply evaluate. But that means the team's got to be making decisions. Another way to think about it is the senior person should only have a brake pedal. Mm-hmm. The next tier below needs to have a gas pedal and a brake pedal. But as soon as the senior person start stepping on the gas, they've then tainted themselves. Hey, we all should, you know, keep selling print film. Hey, we should all rent DVDs, whatever it is. We taint ourselves, and it's very, very difficult to then reverse. So think about that. Am I decision maker or decision evaluator? And if you want to be the decision evaluator, you really got to work hard not to be the maker of the decision.
Yeah, that's great. And I'm thinking back to consulting at Bain, where we would have a decision-making tool for teams called Rapid, in terms of the different roles in a decision, who recommends something, who approves something, who performs, inputs, decides. It's an acronym, Rapid. And then I thought that was great. It's like the approve is like you have veto power, and that indeed makes great sense to put in at sort of senior leadership level. And you just add another layer there in terms of if they're also the one sort of putting forward, hey, this would be really cool, don't you think?
Yeah, right.
It's going to taint things.
Yeah, and obviously we don't do it that obviously, but everybody knows the CEO wants the product to launch. Everybody knows the situation and we have the meeting. The purpose of the meetings, really, is so that the CEO can later say, oh, well, you all were there. You had a chance to say no, but you didn't. That's the real purpose.
Oh, so David, you've laid out a couple of what you're calling the six plays for all leaders about the clock and collaborating instead of coercing. Mm-hmm. Let's go ahead and just rock out the others since we're on a hot streak.
Okay, so on the industrial age side, we have obey the clock, which leads to coercing and the team complying with the purpose of continuing the production line as long as possible. When Henry Ford started making Model Ts in 1904, he made the same car for almost 20 years. If you worked on that line, you basically didn't have to learn any new tools, any new skills. You worked there almost 20 years making the same car. What you want to do now is control the clock, collaborate, then commit, because commitment comes from within. True collaboration will result in the team making a commitment with the idea of completing. So doing the work in chunks. Hey, we're going to do a segment. So I like to think of it in terms of an expiration date or running an experiment. Hey, we're going to change the process. We're going to run an ad campaign. but not, we're just going to run an ad campaign until we feel like we're going to stop running it. We're going to run this ad campaign for 3 months, and then we're going to see not only what we've achieved, but what we learn. And then that gets us to the fifth play, which is improve versus just prove. We have this approach during the industrial age, I got to get it done. I got to show, I got to demonstrate competence. I got to feel good. I got to justify my salary. But that moves us away from this idea of how can I learn? How can I be curious? How can I get better? So, and a lot of companies have these quarterly goals. And when you look at them, they're goals. Like, what are we going to do? We're going to sell 8% more of this, and we're going to ship this. But they're lacking, when I ask them, well, show me what you're going to learn this quarter. Even university, I work with a university, like even they didn't have learning goals. So I'm not saying don't have doing goals. But balance them with, here's what we're going to do, and here's what we're going to learn. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to pause, complete. Complete allows two things. It allows you to pause and reflect and improve the work, but it also allows you to celebrate. No completion, no celebration, no celebration, no sense of progress, no sense of progress, no fun at work.
Yeah, certainly. And so it's interesting when it comes to doing versus learning, I guess I in my brain, I see maybe an overlap in the Venn diagram stuff. Like if I'm saying, hey, I want to learn about audio and what I want to do is make our podcast sound as amazing as possible, sort of both are happening, learning and doing.
Yeah. So here's what I think the formula is. Learning results from thinking about something. So you had the thought, I want the podcast to be amazing. Then you say, you know what? If we tried a different kind of microphone, or if we tried Squadcast as opposed to Skype. So you have a hypothesis. Mm-hmm. But then you actually have to do it. Just thinking about it doesn't result in learning. Then you do it. So let's do five. You can't just do one because it might have been a one-off.
Yeah.
Like maybe the internet connection to Pittsburgh was bad that day. Who knows? Mm-hmm. So let's do 10. And then we're going to pause. We complete. We're going to celebrate what we achieved. Then we're going to say, mm-hmm. Hey, what did we learn? Well, 9 out of 10 of them were significantly better. One was worse. Well, was there some special case there? So that's it. So I think this is the cycle of learning, thinking, doing, reflecting. Yeah. It's like this, I draw an H because it's thinking is broad perspective, doing is focus. Because once you make the commitment, you don't want to say, we're going to use Squadcast most of the time. Well, I wasn't really, a couple of them we did Skype, but I wasn't really sure. You want to be precise. You want to be Squadcast 10 out of 10. Mm-hmm. Then we're going to pause, not while we're in the middle of a podcast, but okay, we've done 10. Now let's pause. What does everybody think? Mm-hmm. Let's look at the data, that kind of thing.
The H, I see what you're saying, the shape.
Yeah, and so it's this flip between reducing focus, which means reducing variability, reducing perspective, being focused, and embracing variability. And it's this flip that we have to do. If we don't recognize that we're using our brains in two different ways, what I see is people are sort of crappily focused, and then sort of broadly expansive. But their expansiveness is like this. It's like looking through a periscope on a submarine. There's a whole world out there. But we're like, oh yeah, we're embracing new ideas. But you know, they're 4 to 6 when I could be 1 to 9. Mm-hmm. I don't even know there's a world beyond my fence line.
Yeah, but David, so many of your ideas are really resonating for me here. I guess I'd love to hear if it's a client or someone who just took and ran with these ideas and saw cool results as a result of doing so. Can you give us a transformation tale?
Yeah, I'll tell you a couple of stories. So one that might resonate with readers is McDonald's. Mm-hmm. So working with a franchise out in Oregon, and they had 15 stores, and the ops manager was stressed, and she would every morning, oh, do this, check on that, do that. And she would drive from store to store frantically, telling them what to do and checking on them. We flipped the whole thing around. So she now would get these texts every morning, and the store managers would be checking in with her. Hey, here's what I got. Here's what I see. Here's what I intend to do about it. Come on by if you want. We'd love to see you. Invite your feedback, but we don't need you.
Yeah.
We're going to do it anyway. And she had so much less stress in her life. Over the next 12 months, she lost 50 pounds, a pound a week.
That's good.
And she had some bad health markers and was sort of pre-diabetic. And all that stuff went away because we simply flipped it. We got rid of that old industrial age playbook.
She may have been eating at places other than McDonald's because she didn't have to go there as often. It's so tempting to smell those fries.
Yeah, it's so hard. They're so good.
Well, if I could follow up. So that sounded like a tidy little framework there. So each person said, here's what I got. Here's what I see. Here's what I'm going to do. Can you lay that out for us?
Yeah. So we have a framework that we apply to empowerment, which we call the ladder of leadership. And it's simply the words that you say. We cast away the word empowerment, and it sounds like this. At the bottom, there's tell me what to do. That's obviously very low. And then there's here's what I see. Here's what I think. Here's what I would like to do. Now, the key there is unless you get approval, you don't do it. So you wait.
Mm-hmm.
And then here, level five is here's what I intend to do. Tomorrow at noontime, I intend to launch a new ad campaign. Tomorrow, next week on Wednesday, I intend to launch the product as scheduled. Now, the key about intent is unless you say no, it's going to happen. So if you don't get through your email that day, you're not holding the team up. And here's the key. The team knowing that there is going to happen, it's on them. They can never, they own it. They can't say, oh, well, the boss told me, I knew it was a bad idea, but
right.
Blah, blah. So it's a trick, so to speak. It's a mechanism to get thinking, because when you know, if you say something, your boss doesn't look at the email, it's going to happen. You become invested. You check with the person to the left and right. Hey, does everyone think this is a good idea? I want to make sure it's good because it's going to be on me if we do this. So the way we would make reports is, so imagine in a submarine or oil refinery, nuclear power plant, operating room, we always report in that sequence. Here's what we see. So it's description. And then here's what I think, which is analysis. And then here's what I think we should do, action. So the first step is detect. I had to notice something. So it's D2, A2, detect, describe, assess, act. And we always go in that order because we're moving from safe to less safe, because description is pretty safe. Hey, I noticed the patient's turning yellow.
Can't argue with that.
You may not know what you need to do. That's okay. If you say, don't bring me a problem without a solution, guess what you're going to get?
Crickets.
Fewer people telling you problems.
Yeah.
That's what you're going to get. Because you just made it, every time you make a speed bump to a behavior you want, you're going to get less of the behavior that you want. So you just put a speed bump on the behavior of reporting problems. So you say, bring me problems. You don't have to have a solution. If you have a solution, bonus points for you.
Yeah.
So anyway, studies have showed that's exactly the impact. So we have these well-meaning words, but they often counterfire.
And what's the final play?
So the final play is in the industrial age, because leaders were coercing workers what to do, the final play in the industrial age is conform. We don't want to appear approachable because it just makes it harder for us to get them to do what we want them to do. So we conform to our role in hierarchy. The new play is connect. Connect as humans. If you're going to ask people to make decisions, decisions pass through the emotional wiring in our brain. We want to think they're all rational, but they're not. I mean, who am I going to marry? Where am I going to school? What's my profession? At the end of the day, it's always an emotional component to that decision. Healthy decisions come from healthy emotions. Healthy emotions come from feeling human at work, which means we have to connect as human beings. And so there's a lot of legacy behavior at work, posturing. And I was in a big global corporation. You could tell you were getting closer to the more important people because the carpet was getting thicker. And there's all these trappings of hierarchy. We don't need to reinforce hierarchy. What you want to do is actually reduce hierarchy, not to zero. A, you can't, and B, I don't think you want to. But we got to get the connection of humanity back into work if you want your people to be involved in decision making. If you're going to ask them what they think, then that's decision making. So that's what the final play is.
All right, thank you. Now, could you share a favorite quote, something you find inspiring?
I really like, I sound maybe like a geek, but I really love Churchill's use of the language. And so when you take a quote like his, "We shall fight on the beaches," and you look at the words he used. Now, I had an opportunity to see a museum exhibit where he had some drafts of his speeches, and he had different words. And the pattern was he was always going back to the Anglo-Saxon variant. So he could have said, "We shall travail on the shoreline," but those are French.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And how about a favorite book?
I love what's popping in my head right now, Mindset by Carol Dweck. She talks about having a growth mindset versus a fixed mindset. Thinking Fast and Slow by Kahneman Tversky. So good. I just read also Michael Lewis's book, The Undoing Project, which is about the work that Kahneman Tversky did, where they came up with a lot of these biases. There's a guy here. Here's one that most of your listeners might not have heard of, a guy named Pangsepp, P-A-N-K-S-E-P-P. Psychologist tickles rats to hear them laugh.
Yeah, that sounds like fun.
So anyone who does that, it's got to be interesting. And he's got a number of books. They're very, I don't understand half of what he says, but one of the things he talks about is we're wired with, one of the systems that we're wired with is called a seeking system. This is the curious system. This is the one that says, "I wonder what's behind that corner. I wonder what's over that mountain range." And a lot of our social ills can be traced to some sort of dysfunction in our seeking system. And I just think his stuff is really interesting.
Oh, intriguing. And tell me, is there a particular nugget you share that people quote back to you and that you're known for?
Well, we say build leaders at every level. One of the things I've been saying recently, I've been hearing a lot back, is push authority to information, not information to authority. And what we're referring to is in a hierarchy, all hierarchies have the same characteristic, which is the information rests at the peripheral of the hierarchy and at the people at the periphery of the hierarchy, the ones in the code, talking to the client face-to-face, in the operating room, flying the airplane, whatever. But the authority for making decisions rests typically in the middle. So the 20th century approach was to create systems and scorecards and software where we aggregated the information from the periphery and channeled it into the middle for a decision. And what we say is what you want to do is take the authority for making decisions and push it out to the periphery as close to the people who natively have that information. You get much faster feedback loops, you get much more resilience, agility, adaptability, and you get more responsible behavior by those people. And it's more fun and they feel like their jobs matter.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And if folks want to learn more or get in touch, where would you point them?
So our program is called Intent-Based Leadership. So go to the website, Intent-Based Leadership, and I am on social media. I give myself a grade of like D+ mm-hmm. for social media. But I'm on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn at L. David Marquet. And the other thing we have is a thing called Leadership Nudges. We have almost 300 now, come out once a week, a 1 minute. A lot of these things we talked about are in these little leadership nudges. So 1 minute video, low production quality, me just talking into the camera saying, "Hey, when you go to ask a question, start the question with how. It'll be impossible to ask a binary question, and it'll be a better question."
Mm-hmm. Well, David, this has been a treat. I wish you lots of luck and keep up the good stuff you're doing.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
I really loved David's simple shift of vote first and then discuss, as opposed to when you discuss first, then the variability condenses and we hear less from folks. I might even say, get people to vote anonymously so they can't look at reference of what's sort of the most influential or the boss or the highest paid person, whoever they're trying to kind of impress or be similar to, that influencing impact is not there. I know other organizations have a rule where the most junior person speaks first, and that can be comparably good to cultivate more variability, more dissent, and as a result, get the best possible ideas out there and select it. And I'm digging. David's flavor there. So again, the show notes, the transcript, the links to items we've referenced are awesomeatyourjob.com/F546. And if you want to catch our next guest, and I hope you do, if you push subscribe, you'll catch our next guest automatically. It's Simon Sinek. You may have seen or heard from him. He's got a few bestsellers, and he's got a TED Talk that was like the third most watched TED Talk of all time. So he is talking about the infinite game, a mindset shift on what we're trying to accomplish and how we should think about what we're playing. Hope to catch you there. Peace.
Thanks for listening. To get the most out of the show, we recommend two key things. First, check out the extra resources at awesomeatyourjob.com. You can find this episode's transcript and links, as well as the perfect episode for your situation. You can search the full text transcripts of hundreds of episodes or explore episodes tagged by topic and competency covered. Second, subscribe to the podcast and get future episodes automatically. You can subscribe by telling Siri and several other smartphones and speakers, subscribe to the How to Be Awesome at Your Job podcast, or by tapping subscribe in your podcast player of choice. If you'd like some extra help figuring out podcasts and how subscriptions work, visit awesomeatyourjob.com/subscribe for guidance. Hope to catch you on the next episode of How to Be Awesome at Your Job.